It seems like interest in using native plants in home gardens just continues to grow. And it's no surprise, since they have a lot of qualities to recommend them, including being able to stand more weather extremes, and also by providing food and habitat for wildlife. Hello, I'm Joy Cardine, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on this edition of Garden Talk. Good to have you along. Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery comes by a few times a year to talk with us about how to use native plants and why you should appreciate them. Thanks very much, Neil, for being here.
Thank you, Joy. It's great to be back again.
Well, we talk about how prairie plants do especially well in hot, dry conditions. Now, this summer was really not all that warm, and there have been some dry stretches, however. How have different types of native plants done this summer?
You know, it's really interesting to watch the response of plants in any given year. And it has been an unusual year, just compared to 2 years ago during the drought of 2012, when it was extremely hot and dry. And amazingly, most prairie plants just soldiered right forward. This year, what has happened is the balance of the plant community, if you will, the performance of different plants has shifted. So the plants that actually thrive under very hot, dry conditions are kind of poking along this year because their biological activity is greater under higher temperatures. So they're kind of flowering less, not as big. For instance, a butterfly weed, which normally does really great in hotter weather, is just kind of sitting there this year. And pale purple coneflower, another plant that has a deep taproot, just like the butterfly weed. Those plants are adapted to hot, dry conditions. This year, it flowered okay, but not any really great show. Whereas other plants that like cooler conditions are putting on a wonderful show.
Well, like what?
Oh, like some of your, like the sweet black-eyed Susan, the orange coneflower, the rudbeckias. A lot of those just did gangbusters this year. Purple coneflower. And the purple coneflower, which, of course, is the perennial that kind of broke open the native plant scene 25, 30 years ago. It's not really a prairie plant. It's kind of a woodland edge plant. So in hot, dry weather, like in 2012, it only grew like 12 to 18 inches tall and barely flowered. This year, it's magnificent because it likes the cooler, moisture conditions.
Well, great. So early fall is a good time to give our native plants some attention. What should we be doing?
Well, there's a lot of different things you can do. Some gardeners like to increase their plants by division. And you can divide plants either in the late fall after they go dormant, or you can do that in spring as well. A particularly beneficial time to divide plants in the fall is for woodland plants, early bloomers. And these aren't, you know, not prairie plants, but we work with all different kinds of plants at Prairie Nursery. Even though we're called Prairie Nursery, we have a nice broad line of woodland plants. And there are certain woodland plants that can be divided. And because they come up so early in the spring, you want to get a jump on that, because a lot of times you're busy in the spring and all of a sudden, oh my God, the woodland plants are already up because they come up so soon. So by dividing them in the fall, it gives them a little time to get their roots situated. Many of the woodland plants are spring ephemerals. They're dormant by July or August, so they're it's a perfectly safe time to divide them because they're not actively growing. They're dormant. So you can do your divisions now or later in September, October, depending on the activity of the plant, and then they'll have a head start for spring and you'll get better results.
Well, great. So let's talk about some of the do's and don'ts when it comes to dividing our native plants.
Okay, very important to know which ones you can divide. There's some general rules of thumb. If you look at the morphological structure of native plants.
The what structure?
Sorry.
No, just kidding.
morphological. The design, if you will. In particular, the root systems. Mm-hmm. For instance, plants that have tap roots, like we talked about the butterfly weed, pale coneflower, the cream false indigo, white false indigo, blue false indigo, compass plant, prairie dock, plants that have deep tap roots are not dividable.
Okay.
Also, your blazing stars, which are actually corms. They look like bulbs, but technically they're a corm. It's a bulb-like form under the ground. These also typically are not divisible. So people will dig them up and try and divide them, but
Ooh,
they end up killing them.
That's too bad, yeah. Okay.
Whereas there are plants that have more fibrous roots, like your grasses, your tradescantias, the spiderworts. These plants are more easily and readily divisible. Bulb plants, like the alliums, the onions, these form little bulbs off to the side, and you can dig them up in late fall or early spring and just tweeze them apart or just gently pull them apart and make new plants out of those. And then there are plants that have rhizomes, plants that creep underground by underground roots, and those are usually easily divisible. Generally, you'll need about a 6-inch length of the rhizome, and just dig them up in the fall after the leaves go brown, Now, the rhizomes are usually only 2 or 3 inches under the ground, the soil surface, and you can just cut pieces off, make sure it has a bud on it, and you can usually see the bud at the end of that rhizome, and get about 6 inches of roots on that rhizome, and move it wherever you want, and you'll get a new patch.
I'm Joy Cardine, in for Larry Mueller on this edition of Garden Talk, talking with Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. If you have a question about early fall care for your native plants, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post a question or a comment or a photo on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Well, let's take our first caller. We have Bill in Madison who is with us. Hello, Bill.
Hi, I've got a question about Jack in the Pulpit seeds. I've got a real good crop of them here, and I wonder if I can put them through some sort of treatment and plant them.
Absolutely. Jack in the Pulpit is an easy-to-grow woodland plant. You want to make sure you pick the right habitat for it. It does particularly well in damp soils or any good, rich garden soil in partial shade to full shade. It doesn't like a dry, sandy soil. It doesn't like a lot of sun. It really is a true woodland plant. Take the seeds, and you'll notice the Jack in the Pulpit seeds are very bright red. And what you need to do is remove the pulp or flesh from around those seeds, because that can actually restrict the germination of the seeds. So you can just put that over an eighth-inch window screen and a hose outside. Just kind of hose it down and just gently rub it across that screen until all of the fleshy red part comes off, and you'll have these little round white seeds. Then you can plant those in the fall wherever you want them to come up. And they do need to experience a period of cold, damp conditions, such as they experience in the ground over the winter, which tells them that it's safe to germinate. And this is true of many of our woodland wildflowers, almost all our woodland wildflowers, and many of our prairie wildflowers. If they are ripe, like right now, it's September the 5th, the weather's warm, it's raining, it's like, wow, this is a perfect time to germinate, right? Not so good, because if they germinate now and all of a sudden it's 20 below on Thanksgiving Day, they're gone. So they have these built-in mechanisms of seed dormancies that prevent them from doing that. So they have to experience a period of cold, damp conditions in the ground. Or you can simulate this by mixing them with a clean sawdust, slightly damp, and putting it in the refrigerator for 30 to 60 to 90 days, depending upon the species. And that will simulate those effects. And then you can plant them out in the spring, usually in late March, early April, for most of your woodland plants. But easy to grow.
Sound good, Bill?
Awesome. Okay, So if I go through that cold treatment in the fridge,
yeah,
can I just like plant them, say, like in peat pots, and then let them grow a little bit, and then decide where I want them?
Absolutely, you can start them in peat pots. What I would recommend you do is, can you get hold of those little 10x20 flats, those plastic flats?
Sure.
Or you make your own out of wood or whatever, and fill that with a proper potting soil. A seed starting soil, which is low in nitrogen.
Right.
High nitrogen tends to restrict germination, and you can actually do this process right in the soil. So you can plant them in the soil now and cover it so rodents and things don't get in there. And you can just leave it out in an unheated garage or somewhere where it's protected and will experience the cold conditions. And then take them out and put them in a greenhouse or a window when it's time to start plants late March, early April.
Good luck, Bill. Thanks for the call. Let's take another call from Sue in Milwaukee now. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if Prairie Nursery does any brownfield restoration, and if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we work with a number of clients on exactly these sorts of projects. Brownfields being old industrial sites and oftentimes highly contaminated. You go through a mediation process, usually involving extraction of the material, reburial of it, and then application of topsoil over the area to isolate it from the environment. And we've worked on situations. One project in Chicago, for instance, the pH of the soil, it was a slag dump, and the pH was 8.5 to 9.2. And for those of you that know about pH, the soil alkalinity or soil acidity, anytime you get over about 8.2, 8.5, you're getting into a very difficult growing environment. So it took a lot of soil additions, remediation. We had to add a lot of sulfur to it. And after we got the soil in shape, then we were able to plant prairie on it, and it turned out quite successful. So there's a lot of different situations with brownfields, some complicated, some pretty basic, where you just put topsoil on it. Unfortunately, so-called topsoil in many cases can be clay, it can be gravel, it can be all sorts of different material, and then we have to custom design a mix to match those growing conditions. So we look at the soil type, drainage, pH, nutrient status, etc., and then can provide a program for ameliorating those conditions and improving the soil, which sometimes also involve the addition of organic matter to open up clay, to add organic matter to sandy or gravelly soils, and then specify a seed mix. It's almost always a seed mix because they're large areas and it's too expensive to use plants. So then specify a seed mix that will match those conditions to rebuild the soil and really get some kind of a plant community going there rather than just an old industrial dump.
Thanks very much, Sue. Our next caller is Carlin in East Dubuque, Illinois. Hi, Carlin.
Good morning. I have a question about my hydrangea plant. I have a beautiful hydrangea plant, and it's in too sunny of a position, and I want to transfer it to a shadier spot. What would be the optimum time to move that? I'd have to dig up the whole root ball and everything. Do I wait till spring or do it now?
Well, I'm going to be totally honest with you, I don't know nothing about birth and no hydrangeas, but
okay.
It's not one of our native plants, and I hate to be ignorant on this, but I don't have a lot of experience. Okay. But if it's like any other shrub, most of your woody shrubs can be moved either in the fall or in early spring. Generally speaking, we usually will allow the plants to go dormant, meaning that they lose their leaves, because you don't want to disturb their roots while their leaves are still putting an active demand on those roots for water. So usually by sometime in October, those leaves have fallen, and then it's safe to dig the ball and move it. Conversely, if you want to wait until spring, you can wait until the soil thaws, but don't wait too long, because once the plant starts to bud out, then there will be some demand on the roots for water. So you always want to move the plants generally before the buds start to open in spring. So either latter part of fall or the early part of spring. There are some exceptions to this, like conifers. If you are moving pine trees and spruce trees, now is actually an ideal time to move them, late August, early September, because that allows them to get some root development in the fall before the onset of winter. And conifers are much more susceptible to desiccation during the winter than deciduous trees, because they actually retain their needles. And a lot of people saw this last year. People that moved conifers in September last year got burned because we had such a hard winter and the soil froze and the conifers got no moisture, because they're still taking moisture out of the soil in the winter to service the water needs, although reduced the water needs of those needles over the winter. So you do run the risk of losses when you move conifers this time of year. But normally, 9 times out of 10, you'll have great results.
We'll talk more about early fall care for our native plants. Talk some about what native plants we can be transplanting right now. And we'll have Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, answer more of your questions in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question for Neil about native plants, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post a photo or a question on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Larry Mueller. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Larry Mueller. And we welcome your questions for Neil DeBull, who is president of Prairie Nursery, about native plants at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, by the way, Fred Clark is here with some great advice for tree care and information on an exciting new local wood utilization effort. That's next week on Garden Talk. Well, more calls for you, Neil. We have Mary and Barry Baraboo with us next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Can
yes.
you hear me?
Yes. What's your question?
I have columbine that blooms quickly in the spring, early. And then I was told to just leave it and not to cut it back. And it's getting ugly. And and
yeah.
I wonder when I can cut it back so other plants can grow there.
Well, let's just say columbine is beautiful in spring, but it doesn't age well.
No.
And
I know how it feels.
But once the leaves really start to brown, you can pretty much cut it back because the columbine does most of its growing in the spring. It oftentimes will really go almost dormant in the summer, but it might then resprout in the fall, like right about now. And as do many of your plants that are more spring active, some of them will come back in the spring and produce some basal leaves that will then help recharge the roots for next spring. So once the leaves start to turn brown, you can really pretty much cut back the columbine, but that's usually not till July sometime. And also, if you want it to spread, you want to make sure that you wait until the seed pods are ripe. And the way you tell when the seed pods are ripe is that they themselves will go from green to blue to brown, and the little seeds inside will turn a very shiny black. And when those seeds inside those pods are black, you know that they're ripe. And you can, if you so desire, you can pick those pods, and they'll open up. You'll actually be able to see the pods open up, and then you can pick them very carefully and then spread those little black seeds wherever you want if you'd like it to increase. And columbine is usually pretty good at self-sowing. In fact, some people complain that it actually spreads around too much. So it's a pretty successful plant. But usually by the end of July, you can easily cut that back and not have to worry about damaging the plant.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You bet. Good luck.
Yeah, thanks very much. We have an emailer who didn't leave a name, but that's okay. Please comment on the virus that is attacking impatiens plants. I know they are not native plants. Do you have any idea what's attacking impatiens?
They're probably talking about the New Guinea impatiens annuals, which I don't know anything about. We do have some native impatiens. And they one other name for them is touch me not. Yes, and they are so named because the seed pods explode upon contact when they're ripe. There are two species of the native impatiens. One is an orange flower, and one is a yellow flower. And they're really quite fascinating. I have them still at my advanced age. I still get the biggest kick out of picking the seeds very carefully when they're ripe, and you have to pick them by their stems, and then you put them in somebody's hand, and as soon as they touch their hand, they literally explode. And, of course, the person kind of jumps a couple inches. So, but unfortunately, I don't know anything about the New Guinea impatiens, which I assume the caller or the emailer is referring to.
Are there certain, I don't know, viruses or problems that are attacking native plants in any great proportions this year?
Oh, there's, I don't know about this year, but it's a war out there. There's all kinds of things. For instance, the woman who called about the columbine. Columbines are particularly susceptible to leaf miners. And a lot of people who grow columbine will notice that by the end of spring, the leaves are riddled with little trails through them because leaf miners just love to get into the columbines. There are viruses that attack prairie plants. There's fungi, especially things like powdery mildew. Members of the rose family, a lot of people who grow roses have problems with powdery mildew, and we have those same problems. Not so much on our native rose plants, but on a member of the rose family called Queen of the Prairie, which is a beautiful plant with a lovely, stunning pink flower, but under the right conditions, usually hot, moist conditions, a hot, moist summer, which we didn't have this year, so we didn't have problems with it, but powdery mildew oftentimes will show up on that plant. So there's always, there's something attacking something everywhere all the time, and that's just part of the whole food chain of nature, starting with bacteria and fungi all the way up to insects, birds, etc. Everything has its little niche.
Our next caller is Kate in Oliva. Hello, Kate.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is great because I just don't even want to do these things. I have a lot of jack-in-the-pulpits that I successfully transplanted, about three, and now I have a lot of plants, but a lot of the red seed heads and also false Solomon seals, and I wasn't sure how to best plant those berries. And I have just one other comment quick.
Okay, well, why don't you give me the other comment, too, if that's all right.
Oh, thank you. The touch-me-nots?
Yes.
They're awesome. My kids are great at doing it. Right. To use if you accidentally hit the nettle that's about 2 feet away.
Yes, and you can. The antidote.
you want to
tell people about that?
What happens?
Oh, yes. Oh, well, if you get into nettles, which are horrible, most people probably know what happens when you touch those. If you break the touch me not and use the juice within it, you can rub it along with a nettle touched you, and it instantly takes away the pain.
Medicinal.
The juice from the stems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not the leaves, but the stems. Yeah, it's a very juicy annual native. Yeah, and they really are a blast. You know, there's not much to do where I live. And so, of course, I have internet and, you know, all kinds of stuff, all sorts of movies on demand. But I still like to go out and play with the touch-me-nots. So, but back to your questions about the Jack in the Pulpit seeds and the Solomon seal. We talked earlier to another caller about the Jack in the Pulpit. And
oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. They're very easy to grow. Generally speaking, you'll advance the rate of growth and germination by removing the husk on them. You can just do that by rubbing them on a screen with some moisture, with some water from a hose. And they usually will come up the next spring, whereas the Solomon seal, false Solomon seal, are members of the lily family, and that includes plants like Trillium. Many other members of that family, they are double dormant, meaning the seeds will take 2 years to germinate. They have to spend 2 winters and the intervening summer in the soil to break dormancy. Roses are also very notorious for this. So members of the lily family and rose family are what we call double dormant. So from the time you plant that seed, let's say it's September of this year, you will not see germination until April of 2016, which makes it a real challenge to produce these plants commercially. And in fact, it's easier in many cases to use division rather than seeds for growing these, because you're talking 5 to 6 or 7 years to get a complete a mature plant like Trilliums. And that's why Trilliums cost $12, $15 each, because it takes 6 years to grow a plant from seed. And we do grow those from seed.
Thanks very much for the call, Kate. So, Neil, can you see the Facebook photo of Tom here? Tom on Facebook says, do you have any suggestions for controlling birds' foot trefoil, an invasive plant in my prairie? Any herbicides that targets legumes? It would be helpful to learn about control measures that have not worked as well.
Yeah, birds foot trefoil is a real beast. It's one of those non-native plants that was introduced as a ground cover and sometimes gets out of control. Even worse than birds foot trefoil is crown vetch. And crown vetch actually should be a noxious weed, but because it's been used commercially, I think, by the U.S. DOT on hundreds of miles, if not thousands of miles of highway, they can't, you know, say, oh, it's a noxious weed and we planted it everywhere. But birds foot trefoil can be very competitive. It is a legume, so it has the advantage of fixing nitrogen, taking nitrogen from the air. And if you use a typical broadleaf herbicide to kill it, you, of course, will kill almost all other broadleafs, including the flowers that are in a planting. So, and this is another problem. Birch foot trefoil is fairly susceptible to Roundup, but, of course, Roundup is a broad-spectrum herbicide that also will kill all the grasses mm-hmm. and most of your other flowers. Crown vetch, on the other hand, is resistant to Roundup, or glyphosate, as it is known. And so if you have to kill crown vetch, spraying with Roundup is futile. And you will have to add a broadleaf herbicide or use a broadleaf herbicide instead of Roundup in order to kill it. And it usually will require repeated applications. Very difficult.
I'm Joy Cardine, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on this edition of Garden Talk. We are talking with Neil DeBoll of Prairie Nursery about Wisconsin native plants. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post a question or a photo on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Our next caller is Pat in Rhinelander. Hello, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I have a question. Back in about 2006, I planted seeds from your nursery in an area, and I overestimated the amount that I needed. In fact, I think I called there and got some advice on how to maintain and keep them. So we expanded the area that we doubled about the size of it, and I planted the seeds again, what was left over, and they've been pretty successful. I live north of Rhinelander, actually, so I'm in zone 3B. I think I still am. I have an overabundance of, I should probably tell you what I planted, short prairie mix.
Okay.
And I have an overabundance of showy goldenrod.
So you're on, I assume, a sandy, dry soil, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
yep, I do, and a lot of the other stuff really didn't come up. I have a lot of little blue stem. I have some other stuff, though I'm seeing new stuff every year.
Mm-hmm.
But I would, since I have so much of the showy goldenrod, I was wondering about removing it and maybe replacing it with some plants. And I was wondering, is this feasible?
Yes.
Or not?
Yes.
And what? When should I do it? And those things.
Okay. You're fortunate that your overabundance is showy goldenrod and not some of the rhizomatous creeping goldenrods, which people normally have problems with, such as Canada goldenrod, which, of course, we do not sell because, although it is a native plant, it is quite a, I would say, a noxious weed because it creeps and crawls and takes over. Sometimes you will find that some of our native goldenrods, including showy goldenrod, and in some cases, often on a heavier soil or a clay soil, stiff goldenrod, can reach high levels of abundance. If you wish, you can go out and simply dig them out. Make sure you get all the roots. Fortunately, they are relatively easy to dig. They don't have terribly deep roots. So you can go out there right now. In fact, because they're in full bloom, before they make seed, you could dig them out right now. And if they're, as long as they are still in flower, you don't have to remove them. You can just dig them out and lay them on the ground to dry out because the seeds will not be formed yet because they're still in bloom. So you don't have to worry about them adding more seeds to the ground. You can then come in and put in transplants either this fall or next spring. If you're going to be planting in a large field area where it's not feasible to mulch the plants to protect them over the winter, I would suggest that you do it in early spring. Now, the issue with that is if it's a large area, you won't be able to water it without setting up all sorts of hoses. I don't know if that's feasible or not. That would always be recommended if you're planting during a time when water might be short. So that's why if I'm doing a field planting with transplants, I want to do it as soon as the spring as possible, just as you would plant trees, so when you still have cool temperatures and moisture, mm-hmm. so the plants are not under stress. If you plant in the fall, and this is a very important consideration, it's very helpful to mulch the plants with about 6 inches of clean straw, fresh leaves, something like that, to protect them over the winter, especially a winter like last year, because their roots are not fully developed yet and they're not completely established. So you need to protect them from extreme cold over the winter. If you're in a field situation, that's probably not feasible to be hauling all that mulch out there to protect each and every plant. So you'd probably want to wait until early spring to put those plants in.
Along my drive, it's like when you pull into our driveway, I wanted something pretty on the right-hand side other than just weeds.
Uh-huh.
So my husband and I worked to plant this, and it's he's the one that's complaining about the showy goldenrod more than I am. He's concerned that it's going to choke out other things. I don't know if it will do that or not.
Well, typically it does not. Actually, the showy goldenrod is my favorite goldenrod, but if you have too much of something, it starts to lose its marginal value. So I just love it. I love the form of the plant. I love the form of the flower. But if it's such that you have an abundance of it and you want other plants in there, I would just suggest that you select some areas and just simply dig them out. It's no need to use herbicides with it because it's pretty easy to dig out. And then where you've dug them out, you can put in transplants of some other plants that are adapted to growing in your dry, sandy soil, whether that's a different flower or some other grasses that you like as well.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much, Pat, for the call. Good luck. We have lots of calls about prairies. Todd and Delavan emails, when is the best time of year to do a controlled prairie burn, spring or fall?
Ooh, there's a big question. When is the best time to do a controlled prairie burn? That depends upon your prairie.
Okay.
For instance, if you have a dry prairies have a preponderance of early spring bloomers. Normally, you would want to burn those in the fall, latter part of fall, after most of the plants have gone dormant, usually sometime after October 15th. However, and the reason you do that is because you don't want to burn in the spring when those flowers, those early bloomers are actually in bloom, because that will not be very good for them. Okay, typically, most people have what we call mesic or medium soils, loam, silt loam, sandy loam, clay loam, soils that take a while to warm up in the spring and are susceptible to invasion by cool season weeds and grasses like quackgrass, smooth brome grass. Bluegrass is actually a weed in the prairie because the bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass, can compete very heavily with your prairie wildflowers and grasses, as well as clovers, red clover and white clover. These are some of the biggest perennial weed problems that we see in prairies as they become established. So what we do, because most of the prairie plants are what we call warm season plants. They like warmer soil temperatures, hotter air temperatures before they will begin growth. They usually will stay dormant until in central and southern Wisconsin, usually until about a third or fourth week of April. This year, I think it was a third or fourth week of May, which was very unusual. But normally around late April, they will start to wake up and emerge from the soil. So prior to that, usually 4, 5, 6 weeks before most of your prairie plants come out, with some notable exceptions, but before most of them come out, the cool season weeds and grasses have already begun growth. And this is what gives them a competitive advantage, is because they get a head start.
Mm-hmm.
So with that head start, they start to lock up nutrients and moisture before the prairie plants that emerge later can get a hold of. So what we do is we use the advantage of the cool season non-native plants against them, and we allow them to grow, usually about 5 or 6 inches tall. Now they have taken energy out of their root systems to produce new leaves, but they've not had sufficient time to photosynthesize and replenish the roots with the energy that was extracted to create those new leaves. So what do? We burn them right to the ground. If you can't burn it, you get a mower and mow it right to the dirt. Put your mower on the lowest setting and mow down to the dirt, which will simulate the effects of fire. So now we have burned back the leaves of the cool season non-native weeds and grasses. They have received little time, if any, to replenish their roots, so they're already at a disadvantage. And when we burn, the soil turns black, and it absorbs the sun faster, thus changing the soil temperature regime drastically into a much warmer regime. In fact, a study I did at Green Bay 35 years ago, we found that the soil temperature 4 days after burning on May the 1st, by May the 5th, 4 days later, the soil temperature was 18 degrees Fahrenheit higher on the burned than the unburned test plot. So it makes a huge difference. So for most prairies, we're going to burn in late April, early May in southern Wisconsin. For dry prairies, you're almost always going to burn in the fall, so you do not damage your early blooming flowers.
I get it. All right. Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Joe in Dousman. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a little bit out of your bailiwick, but do you know of a safe method for disposing of castor bean seeds?
Oh, boy. I know that castor beans are toxic, but I honestly don't. You know, maybe you could wait for one of those clean sweep deals when people are getting rid of their pesticides and take it there. I've never heard that question. So, I honestly don't know.
Yeah, sorry about that. So let's go next to Bob in Union Grove. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead with your question.
My question is, I have ferns taking, I don't even know if a fern is a prairie plant, but they're taking over my entire garden area, and I'm wondering if I can transplant them, and if so, when?
Okay, easy to do. You know, there are ferns that are well-behaved, and there are ferns that love to creep and crawl. And I'm going to guess your fern is probably, what, 3-4 feet tall? Is that correct, Bob?
Yeah, 2.5, 3 feet tall.
Yep, yep. And they creep, and they just, they pop up everywhere. You probably have ostrich fern. Okay, and ostrich fern loves to take over. I mistakenly put it in my woodland garden many years ago, and I'm constantly pulling it out. But it's very easy to transplant. Ostrich fern has a rhizome. And if you're going to move the plants, you can move either the clump itself, or you can find the rhizome that's attached to that clump and dig that out. But probably the best thing for you to do is just to dig the clump and follow the rhizome. If you want to completely remove it from the area, get all the rhizomes and get them the heck out of your garden and move them somewhere where they have room to run where you won't mind it. So dig up the whole clump, follow the rhizomes, pull the whole thing up and move it wherever you want, and it will just be pleased as punch. And around my house, I don't have a problem with deer, but where I put the ostrich fern in the woods, the deer actually graze it down in the spring, and they actually help to keep it under control. So there's one good thing about deer. Only one thing, and they taste good.
Say, can I dig up my friend's black-eyed Susans and transplant them in my yard right now?
Excellent question. There are many different black-eyed Susans. There are perennial black-eyed Susans, and there are biennial black-eyed Susans. So obviously, biennials, which produce usually a basal rosette of leaves the first year, then they bloom the second year. After they bloom, they make seeds and die. So digging up a black-eyed Susan, a biennial, like our typical black-eyed Susan, after it blooms, you're just digging up a dead plant.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. All right.
Whereas there are perennial black-eyed Susans like Rudbeckia fulgida, the orange coneflower. There's a Goldsturm is a variety that's commonly sold. We sell just a straight native. Then there's sweet black-eyed Susan, which is a wonderful perennial, a terribly underutilized perennial. It's great for heavy clay soil. It gets 4, 5, maybe 6 feet in optimal conditions. It will tolerate some shade, not deep shade, but you know, half a day of sun, it will just thrive. And they'll tolerate a little bit of moisture. So if you have a damp clay soil in shade, which is oftentimes a very difficult landscaping situation, the sweet black-eyed Susan is a fantastic plant. It has excellent foliage. It holds up all year long. It doesn't get ratty at the end of the year like some of your black-eyed Susans. And it's a strong perennial.
Excellent. I'm going to look that up, the sweet black-eyed Susan.
Yes, and very easy to transplant and move somewhere else.
All right, let's try Karen and Nina next. Hi, Karen. What's your question for Neil?
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a contorted filbert. I don't know if you know anything about those. Harry Lauder's walking stick is another way to call it. But this summer, it's over 20 years old. It's about 6 feet tall. I am down to now a quarter of the plant left. Never had problems with it before. I've heard of a blight, an eastern blight, that affects it. And I'm wondering what I can do to maybe save what's left of it.
Wow. Well, you know, there's these weird selections of our native plants, and I don't know if contorted filbert is a selection of our native filbert, the Corallus, Corallus okay. Americana. There's two. We have Corallus Americana and Corallus cornuta. These are our two native filberts that grow in Wisconsin. I'm not really up to speed on these selections. The first question to ask you is, did the entire plant leaf out this spring, or did it come out with only one quarter of the plant?
No, it leafed out completely.
Okay, and so it looked good all the way in through midsummer?
Yes.
Okay, so there was not a winter damage, because a lot of trees and shrubs got really, really hammered with the winter. So, okay, so
yeah,
you're pretty.
No, it came back. It looked wonderful this spring, and then chunks of it started, like losing leaves, and it's down to bare wood now.
Here's one thing you can do. When did this start? When did you start to lose the leaves?
I would say it was July.
Oh boy, that's not good. That's not good. Well, you can do kind of an autopsy. Take a penknife and just scrape the bark off in a small spot. Scrape mm-hmm. the bark off in an affected area. If it's green underneath the bark, that means the stem is still alive. But if it's brown, it means it's dead.
Okay.
Okay? But that doesn't answer your question. Honestly, as far as blight on filberts, you know what you can do is you can talk to somebody in the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. There are experts there that can help you with this question. And the state has some very, very qualified people and talented people that can assist you. So I would say on Monday, call the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection and ask them for their shrub blight specialist, and they'll have somebody to help you.
Good luck, Karen. Thanks for the call. If you have a question about native plants or prairies and early fall care for our native plants, you can call 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post a question, a comment, or a photo on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, sitting in for Larry Mueller, talking with Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery in Westfield today about Wisconsin native plants, talking about how you can incorporate them successfully into your yard and garden, and advice on early fall care for your prairie and other natives too. Talk some about why you might want to have native plants and grasses in your landscape. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Now, take a look at our Facebook page, Neil, the Larry Mueller Facebook page. We have Rebecca, who posted a photo and wants to know if you can identify the critters that are on her butterfly weed. Are they dangerous? And if so, what should I do about the critters on her butterfly weed?
Okay, the critters on her butterfly weed are aphids.
Okay.
And aphids are just one part of the food chain. They affect most members of the milkweed family. It's not uncommon to see them on swamp milkweed or red milkweed, and occasionally on common milkweed. Interestingly, a lot of people think, oh, aphids, you know, they're sucking the juice out of the plants, which is what they do. They have these little proboscis that stick into the vascular material of the plant and gain sustenance by basically robbing the plant of its energy, of its food. But they are just part of the food chain, and it's very interesting. There's a very close relationship between many aphids and ants. And there are ants that actually farm aphids.
Oh.
Because they collect the honeydew that is produced at the posterior end of the aphid.
The posterior end.
I'm trying to be polite. This is a family show.
Yes, it is.
so they then harvest this honeydew and take it back to their nest, and it's very high in nutrients. So the ants protect the aphids from predators, because ants can be very fierce.
Yeah.
And so they protect the aphids from predators and reap the benefit. They kind of extract a toll from the aphid. It's
fascinating.
It's a mutually beneficial.
But is the aphid a danger to her butterfly weed?
It's going to obviously reduce its vigor, and it's not going to kill the plant, but it's going to sap some of the energy from it. So it really depends upon your attitude as far as what the function and purpose of your garden is. For me, if I go out into my prairie garden and I don't see holes in the leaves...
You wonder what's wrong.
I'm a complete failure because that means I'm not feeding anybody. And the whole purpose of my garden is not just to look good, it's also to function well. And the ecological function of my prairie is to feed all the different creatures that are associated with it.
Because, why do you want to do that?
Why would you want to do a crazy thing like that? Because, I have this weird thing about liking butterflies and hummingbirds and things like that. And, I want little bitty flies that come to pollinate my plants, not only because they produce seeds to sustain the prairie, but because the hummingbirds eat the flies. The hummingbirds are protein eaters. So you have this whole amazing food chain, some of it quasi-microscopic, that's going on out in your prairie, much of which we never even see or even know is going on.
And you're not going to be worried about those aphids, then?
Not at all.
Yeah.
No.
You're feeding the aphids
Feeding the ants, and then something eats the ants, and then, and all the way up the food chain.
Now, is that butterfly weed going to be attracting butterflies?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. In fact, the genus Asclepias, is second only to the dog beans, Opossum, as far as the number of adult butterflies that nectar on its members, on the flowers. So if you're a butterfly gardener, you definitely want to plant butterfly weed and Sullivan's milkweed and red milkweed. Red milkweed is also very important because it is a preferred food source for the larva of the monarch butterfly. And the monarch butterfly the larva will eat just about every member of the milkweed family. But the leaves of them, but the red milkweed is a particular favorite. And you can learn lots more. We have Monarch seed mixes, and we have Monarch butterfly gardens. And you can learn more if you want. You can check out our website at www.prairienursery. That's all one word, prairienursery.com.
Now, speaking of milkweed, Rick from Eau Claire emails, I have a lot of milkweed seeds, and I'm wondering if I can start a bed from them. If so, when is the best time to plant, and are there any tricks to getting them going?
Milkweeds are very easy. I assume he's talking about common milkweed. There are many, many species in this genus.
Let's guess he is.
But common milkweed is particularly easy. In fact, most farmers consider it a weed, hence the name milkweed. The people that named these plants, they weren't really into marketing. Butterfly weed, milkweed, joe pie weed. We have that to overcome when we're trying to provide these plants to people. But people are getting used to that. But common milkweed is particularly easy to grow, and you can just have an area, a prepared site where you've removed weeds and competition. You can simply put the seeds in the ground now, and they will come up next spring. Extremely easy. The butterfly weed, all the members of the milkweed family, and this is pretty much true of almost all your prairie flowers, you can just plant the seeds in the fall. In fact, all of them, you can just plant them in the fall in a prepared bed where you don't have a lot of weed competition, and they'll come up next spring. Many of your prairie seeds also do not need to be planted in the fall, and they will come up just fine in next year. This includes plants like yellow coneflower, black-eyed Susan, bergamot, purple coneflower. Most of your prairie grasses do not need any special treatment. They'll come up the next spring also when planted. You do need to store them cold and expose them to cold temperatures, but you do not have to dampen them. So many species do not require the damp cold treatment, although there are those that do.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. If you have a question about native plants, for Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. Let's go back to the phones. We have Claire in Cedarburg with a question. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I have a nice stand of white woody asters that I got in a native plant sale years ago, and they have been very behaving nicely and spreading slowly, and they make a dense stand under my birch trees, and they seem competitive against the grasses and other plants. I'm wondering if they'd be good to plant along the edge of a native woods on my property.
Absolutely. I assume you're talking about Aster divaricatus, which is white woodland aster, It is a wonderful plant. It's very rare in Wisconsin.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It only occurs in a couple of places in southeastern Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's threatened in Canada, I read.
Yeah.
So it's Eurybia divergens.
Oh, yeah. The aster disaster. Yeah. They've changed all the asters to, they've deported all of the asters to Symphia trichum, Eurybia, oliguneuron. It's just, it's hopeless. So people much smarter than we have decided to make them unpronounceable and undefinable and indistinguishable. So,
is that the same one you're talking about? Though?
Yeah, the same one. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it changed from Aster divaricatus to Eurybia. So, but yeah, anyway.
I read it was threatened in Canada, but I wonder if it's okay to plant here.
Well, it depends on okay. I grew it in my garden. I love it. And it's very well behaved. It's not invasive, as you pointed out. And it is
the
a great
plant. Bees love it.
What's that?
The bees love it.
Oh, asters. If you're into bees, the asters and goldenrods are phenomenal. Both of those generally, yes. Wonderful for bee gardening. And, you'll have good results with this. And it will benefit from light sun, a light shade, a little bit of sun. It actually will produce more flowers if it gets a little bit of sun or very dappled shade. Deep shade, not so good. But in a like you say, under the base of your trees where it probably gets sun from the sides, perfect situation.
Good luck, Claire. Beverly in Rushford is with us now. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. I have four hypertufas. I hope you know what those are. if not, I'll explain it to you. They are planted right now in with the right kind of layered stone and soil, and they've been planted that way for, and they're all different shapes, but they're very heavy, about 3 inches thick, and they are planted with pine trees.
Okay, these...
One is a spruce,
mm-hmm.
and the other three are a very large species of pine tree. Now, because they're getting pretty darn big right now, I am wondering whether or not I can transplant them and when.
Okay, they're in a tufa container?
Yes.
Okay, when you say very large, how tall are they and how big is the soil ball?
Well, I don't know how big the soil ball is, but I know that they're a good 2 to 2.5 feet high now.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit more because they've been growing tremendously this summer.
Sure, but they're inside these containers, correct?
Yes.
So you'd know the volume of the soil within that container?
I would be purely guessing.
Okay.
And I'm not good at guessing.
Okay. Well, if I was going to transplant those, I would do it right now. And after you transplant them, mulch them with at least 3 to 4 inches of shredded hardwood bark around them to protect them over the winter. And water them in very, very well late in the season to make sure the soil is really moist around them going into winter. That would be sometime before the soil freezes.
Thanks, Beverly. Good luck. Don in Boaz is our next caller. Hi, Don.
Hi, this is Don at Boaz. I was going to ask your guest if he can tell me how to perpetuate my beds of wild bergamot growing out here on the hillside. Beautiful field over these lavender flowers. They get about waist high. If I just collect these the seed pods that are visible on them now, can I plant those in other areas and see them come up in the spring?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wild bergamot is very easy. It's a wonderful prairie plant, very adaptable, grows in almost any soil as long as it has at least a half a day of full sun. And those seed pods, are you seeing seeds in them, Don? A lot of times they're...
Well, they're little black...
kind of brownish?
Black, brownish things. Yeah. They got to be seed pods.
Okay. Out. So they're still in there. They haven't dropped yet?
No.
Okay, good. Now's the time. When they turn chocolate brown...
Yeah.
Then they're ripe. And if they are they coming out of the pod? The pods are brown and they're shaking and rattling and the seed is loose?
Wow. Well, I'm going to put them in where there are now some very large beds of autumn olive and goldenrod. And I figure if I destroy those nasty plants that I don't like and scatter the seeds of the bergamot, will I be successful?
Absolutely. Well, you're going to have to make sure you get the autumn olive and the goldenrod completely killed and then open up the soil. It will really do best if it has an open soil environment because the seed will germinate best under those conditions. But get rid of those bad boys first, and then you can scatter that seed this fall, and you should have a large bed of little bergamot seedlings coming up next year. Usually under good conditions, it will bloom in the second year. If there's a lot of competition, it will bloom in the third year, a third growing season. So expect blooms in 2016 and 2017 if you do it this fall.
You know, Neil, we focused on lawn care last week on Garden Talk, but you have some things to add, especially about low and no-mow lawns.
Yeah, for people that hate mowing like me, there are options to the what I call the lawn treadmill. And it's a beautiful system that has been developed by the lawn care people, is that we fertilize your lawn, so we have to mow it more often.
Right.
And we're going to put all these nasty chemicals on it to keep the weeds out. If you mow the lawn, depending, you know, mowing is a good way to keep most weeds down, but some weeds actually proliferate after mowing. Dandelions, for instance. If you stop mowing your lawn, dandelions disappear. Same with Creeping Charlie, because the lawn grasses will actually smother it. So that doesn't mean there aren't other weeds that can get in there. But we have a product called our No-Mow Lawn Mix, and it's composed of six different varieties of fine fescues, which are much more drought-tolerant, they're deeper-rooted, and do not require the level of nutrition that a Kentucky bluegrass lawn does. So it's a great ecological alternative to a high-maintenance, high-chemical, high-watering Kentucky bluegrass lawn. It is best adapted to well-drained soils like a sandy loam, loamy sand, loamy soils, not heavy clay. And it also does extremely well in semi-shaded situations. It is the most shade-tolerant choice out there. Where you can't, if it's too shady to grow a bluegrass lawn, the No-Mow usually will work. I actually use it as trails in my oak hickory woodlands, and it does beautifully. And I don't mow it. I don't do anything to it. Now, some people will mow it every month or so to keep it in a more manicured look. My lawn, it comes up in, it sends up seed stalks in June. I mow them down at 4 inches, and that's usually my maintenance for the year. And we can talk more after the break.
Well, we have just a minute to go. So what is there? Is there something we can do today to get started on our fall maintenance?
Well, if you want to maintain, or you want to seed. Fall is the time. September is the time to seed lawns. So
right.
The next 3 weeks is your window opportunity. If your site is ready, it's weed-free, and you have open soil, now is the time to plant your seed, because weeds do not germinate very much in the fall. They mostly in spring. Lawn gets started now, and it's boss by spring.
All right. Thanks. Neil DeBole is president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Larry Mueller today for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry will be back next week. Also next week, we will have another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Native plants add a lot of beauty and interest to a landscape, but besides that, they often thrive in conditions that would have many plants wilting or worse. Hi, I'm Joy Cardine, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on this edition of Garden Talk. Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery knows a lot about native and woodland plants and grasses, and he always has great advice to share, whether you have a few square feet or acres of prairie. If you have a question for Neil, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Lots of photos of native plants or critters. And one listener was hoping that you might help identify, Neil, a plant on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. It says, another plant to identify, Dunn County, wet prairie. Thank you. I don't know if you can recognize that or not.
Yeah, it looks like Spirea tomentosa, which is a native shrub. I'm really bad at the common names. Hang on a minute here. Spirea tomentosa, I should be able to just mention this right away. But it is a beautiful shrub with pink flowers, nice foliage. It grows in very damp soils in full sun to very light shade. It doesn't like very much shade whatsoever. It's common throughout Wisconsin. A common name is steeple bush. It's a long-lived perennial shrub. Very, very pretty. And we offer that among many other shrubs as well. We have a lot of native shrubs to go along with our wildflowers, grasses, and our sedges.
And you can find those on the prairienursery.com website or your catalog.
Yep, you bet.
Let's go to Dennis in Ogdensburg. Hello, Dennis.
Hi. Say, first off, I just want to stand up for goldenrod. A lot of people think it's a terrible, terrible thing, but it is really one of the strongest survivors from the prairie. It's everywhere, and a lot of other plants didn't stand up to the invasions. And it draws all kinds of bees and pollinators. So it may invade once in a while, but it's really a good plant.
Yeah, Neil, you're a big fan. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, my real question is this, Neil. I've called you not for about a year, but you were working on a prairie plant guide.
Yes.
If you've gotten it done.
No, but it's close. It gets closer all the time.
What is this?
I hope.
Oh, it's a book that a friend and I are working on. It's called The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. We were hoping to be done a couple years ago, but we need a little more of this, need a little more of that. That picture needs to be better. So we are taking our final photos this year, and so far we are on track, and we hope to have it submitted to the publisher hopefully by the end of this year. And, of course, then they have to go through the editing process, printing, et cetera. So realistically, it's probably going to be another couple years before it's out, but it's going to be a compendium of prairie flowers and grasses that are typically used in prairie gardens and meadow restorations, prairie meadow restorations, with a ton of information about the plant and the pollinators they attract, the host plants for different butterflies, moths, etc., and photos of the plants in various stages, all the way from seedling through flower into seed. So it'll be a great identification guide for people that can use it all year long to figure out what those plants are that they're looking at in their prairie.
Boy, sounds like a bestseller to me.
I hope so. It better be after all these years.
I'm looking forward to it. Can't wait.
Thanks for your... your comment on goldenrod, Dennis, because I'm a big fan of goldenrod. Oh, but there are nice goldenrods and there are not nice goldenrods. The invasive ones are sworn enemies, but things like showy goldenrod, Ohio goldenrod, stiff goldenrod, there are some wonderful goldenrods, as you pointed out, extremely important for pollinators. And pollinators are really under siege right now. And the more we can do to plants that are going to provide sustenance and support for these pollinators, it's in our own best interest, because 33% of the foods that we eat are pollinated by pollinators. And if we lose the pollinators, you're not going to be eating blueberries. You're not going to be eating a lot of foodstuffs that we depend upon now.
So, any other great pollinator plants, native plants?
Oh, they're just
all of them.
Dozens. Well, not all of them, but here's really the trick to creating a sustainable garden or a sustainable meadow, is that you want to have blooms throughout the season, because that not only does it give you color and interest spring, summer, and fall, but it provides food for pollinators and other creatures throughout the season as well. And if you're a bird gardener, you want to make sure you have prairie plants, because prairie plants are unsurpassed at attracting insects. And insects are the primary food of almost all songbirds from birth to maturity. And the exception, of course, are raptors, which generally don't eat insects. But for so many of the birds that we love to see in our gardens, insects are critical, and the prairie plants are phenomenal at supporting pollinators and other insects.
Excellent. Jim in Milwaukee wants to attract some butterflies. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you all?
I'm good.
Yes, we have a very small space, and my wife likes hummingbirds. My kid likes to watch the butterflies. Wondering if there are a few plants that attract both?
You know, that's a great question, Jim. You know, a lot of people think of prairies as being just for large areas, but in fact, you can use these plants in very small gardens. In fact, in our catalog, we have hummingbird gardens, bird gardens, butterfly gardens, one for all different situations, and they are for small areas, just 40 or 50 square feet. So if you you can go on our website, they're also on our website, or you can call and get a copy of our catalog at 800-476-9453. We're open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. So feel free to give us a call, or you can just email us at, check our website at prairienursery.com and sign up for a catalog, and we'd be happy to send that to you.
Oh, great. Now, would there be a flower that would be suitable for both? Would, like, one flower or plant attract both?
Well, there are many flowers that attract both hummingbirds and butterflies, and there are some that also produce seeds that are good for birds as well as the insects they attract. But what you really want to do is you want to have a sequence throughout the season, as we mentioned earlier, so that you are able to support butterflies with nectar plants all summer, spring, summer, fall, and as well as the other visitors like hummingbirds, et cetera. So you want to have a sequence of blooms so you're feeding them throughout the growing season. Each individual flower will only bloom usually for 2, 3, 4 weeks. So you don't want to just plant one or two flowers. You want to have a lot of different flowers, which gives you more interest and gives you more opportunities to support these visitors.
And don't mean to but certainly you want to do that in that sequence, but is there a popular native plant that butterflies love and hummingbirds love?
Oh, sure. The coneflowers. Purple coneflower, pale purple coneflower, the blazing stars, the Joe Pye weeds, Eupatorium. This is a phenomenal genus as far as a nectar plant. The butterflies just flock to that. If you're looking at hummingbirds, there's cardinal flower, and there's wild petunia. There's also the royal catchfly, which is a beautiful red flower, and the hummingbirds fight over that. And if you get our catalog or go to our website, you'll see that the plants are marked accordingly for those that are best for attracting hummingbirds, regular songbirds, butterflies, etc. We also have plants that are deer resistant. Not deer-proof, but deer-resistant. So plants that deer generally don't eat. And we have gardens and seed mixes designed to provide those sorts of gardens for people as well, using those plants that deer don't eat.
Excellent. Lynn in La Crosse. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Neil, we purchased three red milkweed from you back in 2013. Last year, they didn't have any of the monarch caterpillars, so I topped them back in the fall after they were done blooming. This year, we have about six monarch caterpillars, and I don't know what to expect. I don't want to cut them back if the caterpillars are going to be living on the milkweed. And so I'm wondering about what to expect with that. And then also, we purchased plants, and it's about a 4 by 15 foot area. And we have a variety of plants that we purchased from you, and they're just taking off this year. And again, we don't know how to take care of it, whether we should cut it back in the fall or leave it throughout the winter and cut it in the spring. So wondering if you could suggest some answers there.
Sure. Lynn, these are great questions. First of all, you didn't see any monarchs last year because monarchs were in dire straits last year. It was the worst year in recorded history for their populations. Fortunately, they are beginning to rebound this year. It's not fantastic, but the populations are much improved. So as far as the monarch caterpillars that you have on your red milkweed, you want to leave those plants alone and let those monarchs form chrysalises. And this is the last flight of the monarchs, and they are then going to hatch out of those chrysalises and then migrate to Mexico. So you definitely do not want to disturb that plant. And as far as whether to cut the plants down in fall or to wait until spring, some people like to tidy up their gardens in the fall. If you're going to do that, I suggest you wait until late in fall to allow the seeds to drop, if you want seeds to regenerate, as well as for the plants to finish their annual cycles. You generally do not want to cut them when they're still green and growing, because that will weaken their production and their regeneration of their roots for next year. If you're interested in wildlife, the best thing for you to do is to allow everything to stand up as late as possible next spring, because many of your butterflies and other insects will overwinter, as some as eggs, some as chrysalises, some as larvae, depending on the species, some as adults. And if you cut everything down in the fall, that can disrupt that cycle. So generally speaking, if you're interested in preserving pollinators and other invertebrates, you'd want to wait until as late as possible next spring, usually the latter part of April, before you cut everything down and then rake it off.
Okay,
does that help?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Lynn. I think that's so cool that she has monarch caterpillars on her milkweed.
So many of our customers are planting milkweeds and butterfly gardens specifically to help the monarchs because all pollinators, because it's just been such a dire situation for them. And pollinators are under siege globally. And anything that we can do, even on a small scale in our gardens, does help.
When are those monarchs going to be migrating back to Mexico?
Oh, probably sometime in October, late September, October. They're like cranes. They wait till the weather is right and then catch the wind and head south.
We're talking to Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery in Westfield about native plants, prairies, woodland plants, grasses. Welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lewis emails, what would be some good prairie/woodland plants for a Milwaukee neighborhood?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it depends what Milwaukee neighborhood you're in. First of all, Milwaukee generally tends to have heavy clay soils. It depends where you are. Some areas closer to the lake might have sandy soils. You never know what you're going to run into. But most of Milwaukee does have heavy clay soils. There are some areas like Mequon and northern air that have very high pHs, where you have pHs over 8, which is a very challenging environment. So you have to select your plants to match your soil conditions. And, of course, for your lighting conditions as far as full sun, full shade, intermediate dappled shade, and moisture. Is it a dry sand? where there's little moisture and it gets hot and dry and burns most plants up. There's great prairie plants for that situation. Is it a heavy clay? Then there are wonderful prairie plants that will grow in clay. We call them our clay busters, and we have a good selection of plants that will grow in clay. So, I mean, there's dozens of plants. So that's kind of a big question. But the most important thing is to evaluate your site, look at your growing conditions, your soil, your drainage, your light, and then look at how it's going to fit in with the neighborhood. Do you want 10-foot tall plants or do you want 2-foot tall plants? What's going to fit with your landscape, the rest of the neighborhood? A lot of people don't like that 10-foot tall plant in a neighbor's yard, but you know, a 2 or 3 foot plant, hey, that looks nice in the garden. So it really depends upon the context as well.
Headed over to La Crosse and Ron. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I got a couple of questions. First off, if we're reseeding in the fall, I would like to know, is putting grass seed in the freezer or refrigerator a good way to prepare it before seeding? And the other thing, I got this weed that's really invasive, and you said something about cutting things down and burning it, and then, you know, that would help rejuvenize that weed-infested area for lawn. We can't burn, but I just wonder if I were to cut this weed, it's a low-level weed, real short with a weed trimmer, and then just maybe even spray it with Weed Be Gone, would that help?
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. First of all, the burning is for prairies, not for lawns.
Okay.
Okay. Most lawns do not respond well to burning because it weakens the sod and opens them up to weed invasion.
So, now you tell me, Neil.
So the burning is for prairies, not for lawns. Okay.
Okay.
It's hard to say exactly what to do about your weed without knowing what the species is, because different weeds have different strategies for survival and propagation. Yeah. So yeah, if it's a broadleaf weed and you're okay with using herbicides, yes, now is a great time to go in and spray weeds, because they are translocating energy down into their roots, and they will accept that herbicide and take it deep down into their roots and kill most, if not all, of the plants. So fall spraying of weeds is actually the best time. Right now, early September is a phenomenal time if that's the route that you want to go. Make sure that you use the appropriate herbicide and be very, very careful. Read the directions and don't get exposed to the herbicide. As far as seeding lawns, September is the month for seeding lawns, for cool season lawns, which are the best choices here in Wisconsin. So you want to make sure the area is completely weed-free, that you don't have any competition, and hopefully you don't have a lot of weed seeds lurking in the soil. But the beautiful thing about seeding in the fall is that the lawn grasses germinate readily in September, and most weeds don't. Most weeds' strategy is to germinate in spring and summer. So the lawn, when seeded in September, gets a head start on the weeds, because any weeds that are going to come up, with a few exceptions that do germinate in fall, most weeds are going to wait until spring to germinate, but your lawn should be fully in control, or nearly fully in control, by the following spring with a fall seeding. Mm-hmm. As far as getting lawn seed to germinate better by putting it in the freezer, no, that doesn't, or the refrigerator. Some of your prairie seeds, absolutely. Many of the prairie seeds do require exposure to cold conditions, and many of them do require exposure to cold and damp conditions, not so much the grasses as the flowers. So for lawns, though, don't worry about pre-treating that. It's ready to go.
Thanks, Ron. Maureen in Princeton is with us now. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. I have a question concerning the no-mow grass. We have, you said it's good in sandy loam, but not in heavy clay. We do have some clay where we'd like to put the grass. Like, since we got rain yesterday, I can stick my finger in it, but if it is really hot and dry, it seems to be pretty solid.
Okay.
Do you have any suggestions?
Well, let me ask a couple of questions. Let's do a quick soil test. Is your finger in the soil right now?
No, it isn't.
Oh, darn. Okay. Well, here's how you can do a quick soil. We call it the field test. Okay. If you take the soil and rub it in your hands, okay, mm-hmm. If you can feel grit to it, then it has a significant sand content. If you can take the soil and rub it between your hands and it forms a ribbon, okay, that's clay or a clay-based soil. If the soil is not gritty, does not form a ribbon, then it's probably more of a loam. And a very important component of a loamy soil is silt. And silt is intermediate in size between the fine clay particles and the larger sand particles. And it will feel flowery as it dries on your fingers. But the most important thing, also, if you take a spade and stick it in the ground when the soil is dry, if it will not go in, you probably have a clay. If it goes in readily, it's probably a sandy or a sandy loam, or probably a loam. So do you have any idea on what those characteristics might be as far as your soil is concerned in that clayy area?
No, I'm not sure. I know we do have some sand, but
okay.
In the spot where we'd like to put the grass, that there isn't much sand there.
Okay, then actually for a heavy soil, if it's got a clay base to it, Kentucky bluegrass is actually a better choice than the fine fescues in our No-Mo mix, because the No-Mo mix really does best in well-drained soils. Sandy loam is the perfect soil for that, or a loamy soil. If it's really a heavy clay or a sticky clay, then you're going to want to go with something more like a Kentucky bluegrass.
Good luck, Maureen. Jane in Wausau is with us now. Hello, Jane.
Hello. I would like to plant a garden that is mainly native or wild plants, and I'd like to include an orange lily, maybe something like a tiger lily, but I didn't see any in your catalog, and I was wondering what you would recommend. And then a second question is, could I also plant whatever you recommend in a sandy soil elsewhere in the state?
Okay, are you looking at putting these lilies in a sandy soil?
No.
Hello?
We lost you a little bit there, Jane.
Oh, no, somebody's trying to call me. I can't believe this happened. It's just going to beep, but we're fine.
What kind? I'm sorry, what did you ask?
Yeah, is the soil?
I would be planting this in Wausau, where there's a nice sandy soil mainly. Yeah.
Okay, and it's well-drained, it's not damp?
Right.
Okay, we basically have two native lilies that are available, and we're presently, the one that we normally offer, we're low on stocks because it takes very, very long time to grow it, and that's called the Turk's Cap lily, and that grows in rich, damp soils with a high humus content. So for a well-drained sand, it would not be the appropriate plant. There's another native lily called the wood lily, which is a gorgeous plant. It's very finicky. It's hard to find. There's, I think, one nursery in Wisconsin that grows it. It's very expensive. And it's a tough one. It's a tough one to grow, but in your well-drained sandy loam, it would probably be a good choice if you can find that. It's not always available. So be careful. The tiger lily is not actually a native lily, what we call tiger lily, and it is the alternate host for a virus that will attack our native lilies. It does not hurt the tiger lily, but it is rather devastating to our native lilies, and it really attacks the leaves. So if you want to grow native lilies, keep the tiger lilies away because it's the alternate host for this virus.
Did not know that. Good luck, Jane. We have Lisa in Eau Claire who emails, I have spikenard that I bought at a native plant nursery in River Falls. It comes up every year and has lots of berries, but it is quite gangly and huge. Should I do anything about it, or should I leave well enough alone? I guess she doesn't want it quite so gangly and huge.
Well, spikenard tends to be a little gangly. I love the plant. It has really nice foliage, and it has a pretty beautiful flower, but what happens is it does tend to kind of spread out. It's not a real compact plant.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a real common plant. It's kind of rare. It's an Aurelia. There's a couple of Aurelias. This is Aurelia racemosa. We have a number of native Aurelias. If you want a more compact plant, that's probably not the one that you want. There are some other ones you may want to consider, like the doll's eyes, the white doll's eyes, or red baneberry. Those are a little more compact. The white woodland aster that somebody called about earlier is also a good choice. But it's going to be gangly no matter what you do. I have it in my yard, and it kind of spreads out, but it's still a nice plant.
Let's go to Deborah in Marquette, Michigan. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. I wanted to respond to the person who was looking for a good woodland plant. And although I never liked hostas that much when I first moved here, or moved to Milwaukee area, I've grown to really love them. And there's a really huge one, Hosta Montana, and it's 3.5 feet. That would be cool.
Yeah, you know, and we're almost out of time, Deborah.
Okay. And then Cardinal Ovealis, but it has to sit in water. But I want to ask you about looking for butterfly eggs, because I often rip off the leaves when I'm picking flowers, like in one motion. What do people need to look for on the backs of leaves before they rip them off?
We have 30 seconds.
You'd want to look, first of all, you want to get a guide to butterfly eggs so you can make sure they're butterfly eggs, because there's all kinds of insect eggs out there. Where that guide to butterfly eggs is located, I haven't the foggiest notion, but I'm sure there's something out there, and you can probably find it on the internet. But that's going to be a pretty technical undertaking, because you're going to have to get a magnifying glass out in order to identify the species of those eggs to make sure that you're not removing butterfly eggs from your plants.
Neil, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Joy. Thanks so much for having me.
And more information at prairienursery.com. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.